hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and this is Dr. Peter McCullough. I'm bringing to this edition to you, we have a terrific lineup of guest speakers today. We've gone through the interviews. I can tell you, I've had a whirlwind time at the end of April. I was on for a brief spot on the Ingram Angle with Laura Ingram. And in her usual troublemaking mode, she tried to get me to attack Dr. Tony Fauci, the head of the National Institutes of Health leading the pandemic response. I wouldn't do it. But I made the comment that as the public health officials are applying scientific data, they are running about 6 to 12 months behind from the knowledge to applying that to the recommendations for the public. And I did emphasize that the recommendations are completely voluntary, completely elective. There's nothing that the CDC or NIH says that is anywhere near close to law or binding in our daily lives. I did give my opinion that wearing masks and giving vaccinations to children and to high school children and college students was not in their best interest. And I raised the issue of for the public to think, whose interest really is it to go after those groups where the viral infection is self-limited? They develop wonderful immunity and there's no evidence of significant asymptomatic spread of COVID-19. Now, I'm broadcasting today from Fort Myers, Florida, and I have a terrific opportunity to go on Tucker Carlson Today for a long segment. I'll give you an update on how that goes. I'm somewhat nervous. I want to be able to make the key points with respect to our advances in early treatment. And I clearly understand the traps of the major media outlets and how they try to run news stories, which they're obviously have their revenues and are trying to garner interest from the public. But I plan to put forward the message of early treatment and how America largely has now had this pandemic be managed by our heroes of early medical treatment. I do plan to mention that we have now four major telemedicine services nationwide and 15 regional ones, 250 treating doctors. And my estimates are over 10,000 appropriately sick patients per day are treated with early ambulatory treatment. And that's really responsible for keeping the mortalities down and keeping our hospitals empty as we hope for some effect from the vaccination. My guests today are Dr. Angelina Farina, and she is a pediatrician from outside Houston, Texas, and she'll give us some of her viewpoints on pediatrics, COVID-19, and whether or not they need vaccination for children. Next is Dr. Alan Bain from Chicago. Dr. Bain will give us some insights on the front line of directly treating sick outpatients with COVID-19 and the progress that we've made. Then I bring on Dr. Norman Lepore, who is a cardiologist and former president of the California chapter of the American College of Cardiology, and it gives the listeners a break from the reign of COVID-19, but talks about the fallout, and that is how COVID-19 has influenced our regular appointments, our ability to get tests and procedures, and our general health. And he makes the point that, you know, hospitals and clinics, doctors, radiology centers, surgical centers have been closed for so long that many patients have fallen behind on their usual and regular care. So Dr. Lepore has some important words for you. And then I finish with Christina Borgeson. Christina is an investigative journalist. She's had producer positions at CNN and CBS. She's written some remarkable essays. One is called Into the Buzzsaw, concerning the TWA crash of fame and notoriety years ago. And Christina gives her input as an investigative journalist with respect to what is going on with COVID-19, what is in the minds of people across the world, seemingly to make this pandemic far worse than it should be. Listen to her. She's not a doctor, but she has cracked some of the biggest stories that have occurred over the last 30 years. And I think Christina is really on to something with her investigative reporting through her independent news outlet called The Whistleblower's Newsroom. So let's kick off. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. You're listening to the McCullough Report.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and you're listening to Dr. Peter McCullough. It's my great pleasure to invite on the show today Dr. Alan Bain. Dr. Bain attended undergraduate at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. He went to medical school at the Midwestern Osteopathic College of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. And Dr. Bain has been a leader in early treatment of COVID-19 for patients in the Chicago metro area. And I wanted to get him his insights on here we are now over a year into the pandemic. And are we making any progress on early treatment? Dr. Bain, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you, sir.
What's your kind of overall assessment of how we're doing with early treatment?
I believe that the doctors that are involved with this are doing extremely well. More information needs to get out to the public, obviously, that early treatment has always existed for greater than 8-9 months. But we are making headway, yes.
And does a single drug do it, or do we need to use drugs in combination?
No, absolutely. We need to do drugs in combination because if you start with one drug, you never know when the illness is going to progress, and it could progress very quickly. So we have to have all the drugs ready and on board as well. And we need the, you know, sequential, multifaceted utilization of these medications.
Now, you've managed some very sick patients in Chicago, even patients who have had reduced pulse oximetry and have become hypoxemic. How frequently do you stay in contact with these patients during a course of treatment?
Actually, very frequently, because I have to keep following them because things can change on a dime. Some of my patients needed early home intervention and they went to the hospital, and then some of them needed continued intervention even when they got home. These would be the tougher patients. One of my patients was on 4 liters of oxygen for a whole month as we did the multi-drug therapeutic interventions.
Do you think that some of these patients almost certainly would have died if they didn't receive your treatment early on?
I believe so, Dr. McCullough. Yes.
I think that's the important thing for the listeners to understand, is that the name of the virus is called sudden acute respiratory virus syndrome, COV2. And it means sudden. Patients can have a sudden decline in their status. And so when patients engage with sick patients at home via telemedicine, sometimes with face-to-face visits, it takes a skilled doctor like Dr. Alan Bain and his team of C19 doctors across the United States who are really breaking through on early treatment. Dr. Bain, what's your opinion on how this is becoming accepted among your colleagues in the Chicago area?
Well, honestly, it could be a little bit quicker and more facile. We are still keeping up the fight. Some of our patients have actually even gone to the intensive care unit, and we have many experts, legal experts, trying to help them get their lives to be saved with adding on extra medications. So this fight still continues.
There seems to be quite a disconnect between the inpatient treating doctors and those managing patients as an outpatient. I don't know a single inpatient infectious disease doctor that's actually ever treated a patient at home. And I think that's one of the difficulties there, where we have very good multi-drug treatment at home and they go into the hospital and it almost seems as if their treatment becomes minimized. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with that, sir. And I've even reached out to infectious disease doctors to try to influence them. I live near the DuPage County, and DuPage County Medical is really getting into the vitamin bundle, as it is called. and they've even put themselves on the Chicago NBC network, but they won't take the next step. And I've written emails and to one particular infectious disease doctor, and they don't seem to get, they get close, but they not so far here in this one area called DuPage County.
Well, the probably the single greatest thing that the medical community can do is make this full pivot to early home treatment. We've gone, I think, as far as the vaccination can take us. We're seeing breakthrough cases now with full vaccination. And we need really heroic doctors like Dr. Alan Bain, who's an innovator, who's been able to think outside the box and work carefully with our hundreds of doctors across the country. Dr. Bain, thanks you so much for joining me on the McCullough Report.
I am honored to be here. Thank you, Dr. McCullough, for having me.
Well, let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report. It's a great pleasure for me to invite to the show a great friend for a long time, a very, very well-respected physician in cardiology, the former president of the American College of Cardiology California chapter, as well as the founding editor of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, Dr. Norman Lepore. Dr. Lepore received his bachelor's degree from UCLA, medical school MD from Johns Hopkins, and then did his internal medicine residency and cardiology fellowship at Cedars-Sinai Hospital in Los Angeles. And he's currently the principal founder and doctor in a leading California Institute for Cardiovascular Imaging and Clinical Trials, as well as clinical practice. Dr. Lepore, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thanks, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here, Dr. McCullough.
I wanted your insights on how the COVID-19 pandemic has influenced cardiovascular care for patients. So many of our listeners have heart disease. What do they have to be on the lookout for?
Well, I think what happened, Dr. McCullough, is early on in the pandemic, people with heart disease or people who had manifestations of cardiac symptoms were deathly afraid of going to their doctor or going to the hospital. So there were actually many people who were stayed at home and had their heart attacks, had their strokes, some of whom died and some of whom were disabled. Those that would have symptoms of an acute event like a heart attack and would make it to the hospital, there was certainly testing involved in terms of determining in a very quick fashion whether they had also COVID-19 infection. If they did, their procedures to stop their heart attacks had to be done in a particular room, what we call a particular cath lab, catheterization laboratory, where we do procedures to open up clogged arteries, that had to be in a particular room where precautions were being taken. The rooms were sanitized, disinfected after every use. The medical staff would have to wear special protective clothing. So it was really, it really did have an effect in terms of how we did procedures. Oftentimes, if that room wasn't available, we would not be able to open an artery with a stent, and instead would have to relegate patients from time to time to get these what we call clot-busting drugs. And we know that these clot-busting drugs are not as good at treating, for instance, a heart attack, like opening the artery with a balloon or a stent. But sometimes patients, just because of resources that were being already used by another COVID-19 patient, would have to be relegated to these less effective clot-busting drugs. And now what we're seeing lately is now that, you know, many people have been vaccinated, they're feeling more comfortable being outside. So now what we're seeing is a deluge of patients presenting to the offices of cardiologists with problems like heart failure, cholesterol disorders that are now finally being treated, and in effect, because they've been untreated, their conditions have worsened over the last year. And also what we see is a lot more obesity and obesity-related complications such as diabetes, fatty liver, because over the course of this 1 year, I would say 80% of my patients were less active, they drank more alcohol, and have found them to have gained significant amount of weight over the last year. So these are just some of the things that come to mind.
Now, we have noticed, we had several cases at our hospital, and we published a paper on this, that patients who are sick with COVID-19 can also simultaneously have a heart attack. And when they do, we found the mortality was higher. And one of the things we found is that the stents were more likely to become acutely clogged with blood clots. Have you found that the virus itself is promotional of forming blood clots?
Dr. McCullough, as you know, as being a world authority on COVID-19 and probably one of the most respected and most read authorities on the subject, we know that one of the things that occurs as an effect of the viral infection is that the virus actually can bind to the cells that line the inside of blood vessels and line the the cells that populate the heart that allow it to contract. So what we see from time to time, and more often with the COVID-19 infections, is we see these different types of heart attacks, different types of blood clots that form. And one of the complications that we're seeing with these blood clots are the effect of COVID-19 on the arteries. Even when we put a stent to open up an artery that has a blood clot formed, another blood clot can open, can actually develop on the stent. So what one of the things that we see, and I know that you know well about this phenomena, is what we call a hypercoagulable state. The virus in some people develops, predisposes patients to actual blood clotting, more blood clotting than they would otherwise have. And so oftentimes, even in patients who would need dialysis and dialysis catheters would be placed, you know, they would find that these dialysis catheters would clot. So there is something about this tricky virus, I call it, COVID-19, which affects both the cells that line the arteries and the cells that make up the heart, and also probably have effects on the platelets that actually lead to blood clotting. And both of these situations predispose to a clotting disorder that makes it that much more difficult to treat these patients who do present with heart attacks and with COVID-19 at the same time.
Well, let's hope we're on the downward slope of COVID-19 with the vaccination program and so many patients having the illness and recovered. Do you have any final words for our audience?
Well, I think the final word for my audience is make sure you're now making arrangements to see your cardiologist. If those of you who have been delaying your treatment and your follow-up, you know, patients with diabetes and coronary artery disease, angina, heart failure, all these conditions really need to be managed closely by our cardiologist. And now the offices are getting very busy because all of a sudden everybody wants to come in at the same time. So I urge you to call your cardiologist now, make the appointment. You may have a bit of a wait, but better to make the appointment now so you're seen as early as possible so we can keep you alive and keep you fit and keep you healthy.
Well, I'll let that be the last word. Dr. Lepore, thanks for joining us on the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, you're listening to the McCullough Report. This is Dr. Peter McCullough, and it's my pleasure to invite on the show Christina Borgeson. Christina received her bachelor's degree from Boston University, then went on to Columbia University and received her master's in journalism. She's had a distinguished career in the media, and she's been a senior producer at CBS, PBS, and CNN, and she now runs and is the principal driver of the Whistleblowers Newsroom, which is really breaking all kinds of barriers as we're working our way through the COVID-19 crisis. And in many ways, she's helping the general public get an idea of what's going on out there, and she's spending a lot of time with doctors and experts all over the world. Christina, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Tell the audience what piqued your interest in the idea of the COVID-19 epidemic being something more than just a medical problem.
Well, you can always tell when there's a problem with a huge story when you get so many different accounts from so many different sides. When you see the press is pushing in a certain direction, and you see the major talking heads pushing in a certain direction, and then you hear frontline people, field people, saying something completely different. And so that's when I started realizing something was rotten in Denmark, as they say. And I started focusing on frontline doctors. And I've just come to this realization after talking to enough physicians and talking to physicians, not just here in the United States, but in Europe. I've just realized something really kind of terrible, which is that, and Dr. Richard Urso, ophthalmology surgeon, put it best. He said, what they did was early treatment, which is very successful for COVID, or it's like more than 90%, 98 point something percent, he said to me, which is very, very successful for COVID, was actually suppressed in favor of contagion control until the vaccine rollout. Now, the interesting thing about early treatment is it involves a bunch of drugs that have been around for a million years, and they're cheap, you know, they're not on patent anymore. And of course, the vaccine rollout is, it was done in very, very, you know, record time. It's experimental, so we don't know, you know, what possible adverse events, effects are gonna occur down the line. So here was something that was really successful, suppressed, even and the false press reporting and the false scientific reporting, including from Harvard on hydroxychloroquine, is emblematic of this part of the suppression efforts.
Well, let me ask you a loaded question. From your vantage point, you've talked to a lot of experts and people around public health officials, whether they be, you know, have the right idea or not, whether they, you know, have operated on the best fundamentals of information available to them or not, they should always have the intent of having the best interests.
The public interest in mind?
The public interest in mind. Do you have a sense that that has not occurred?
Oh, of course. Of course. And I think there's been a lot of pressure on them up the line, you know, pressure coming down from above for them to be in lockstep with whatever the message is coming out of the World Health Organization and out of Fauci's mouth, you know. And I'm just now, like, I've also been talking to lawyers who are suing in courts for things like invalid testing on COVID, you know, invalid COVID testing using the PCR, which is a test, which is not really a diagnostic test. And then you have now Ari Sokolovsky and Ruth Machness, who are suing crimes against humanity, which is just a horrible thing for an Israeli to have to do for obvious reasons. They're suing for the rollout of the vaccine, for the government making deals with Pfizer and thereby forcing everybody in Israel to take these experimental vaccines, because part of their deal with Pfizer is to deliver the patients for this huge national clinical trial. But to me, and that as a crime against humanity, against the Nuremberg Code of experimenting on humans. But to me, the thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands who have died because of suppression of early treatment, that was the first crimes against humanity. That was the first one. And that's what I feel like I just discovered. And it's just, you know, it's kind of devastating.
Let me ask you one last loaded question before I go, because your work is just starting on this. COVID-19 vaccination. We have Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, Chinese manufacturers, World Health Organization, Gates Foundation, National Institutes of Health, CDC, National Health Service, the Canadian authorities, Australian authorities, European Medicine Agency. There are a lot of players involved. Do you have a sense that the worldwide application of mass vaccination in the midst of a pandemic, do you have a sense from the experts you've talked to that this is in the world's best interest?
No, I sense from these physicians a great deal of concern, because there's a pattern here. There's a pattern of suppression of successful treatment that allows your own immune system to deal with the illness, and therefore you have a much better immunity than a vaccine can offer. So that's the first, you know, that was the first, what's going on? And now it's experimental vaccines. They're calling them vaccines, but they're experimental drugs that they have rushed through, okay, and are forcing upon everybody. So, and that's also suspicious, particularly since you could still at any time implement a policy of early treatment with these drugs that are cheaper. They've been around, they're proven, they're not gonna, you know, they're not gonna kill you. They've been FDA approved, et cetera. So yeah, I think physicians, a lot of frontline physicians are deeply, deeply concerned and do not think that this is the best way to go.
Well, your investigative reporting, I think, is critical through the crises that have occurred over the course of modern history. In many ways, the heroes were the independent press and the independent thinkers who broke through the hubris, who broke through the party line and started getting viewpoints and interest in almost every crisis that we've had. Part of it is the suppression of free speech. Yes. And do you have a sense, with all the social media we have and all the emails and things, do you have a sense right now that suppression of free speech is happening?
Oh. The reason why I'm laughing is because I'm dealing with being censored right now by YouTube. I just did this really wonderful interview with Dr. Urso, it's really an amazing interview. And of course, I can't get it on YouTube, right, on my YouTube channel. And even when my time, you know, my censored time is over, it would not last on YouTube. That'll be three strikes and they're going to kick me off forever. So listen, I have published two books on censorship. I was reared in Haiti under Papa Doc Duvalier, who was a major dictator. And I know all about, you know, suppression and dictatorship and censorship. I came to the United States, went to the best journalism school in the world, allegedly, and found myself actually working in one of the most highly censored, but in a much more sophisticated way. It's becoming more frontal now. It's way more frontal now, but very, very sophisticated censorship landscape here in the United States. I published a first book called Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press, investigative reporters talking about their encounters with censorship on big stories, because I had that happen to me at CBS. And then I published another one, which was a series of interviews. It was called Feet to the Fire, the Media After 9/11. And it was about how the press basically allowed itself to be schnookered during the run-up to the Iraq War with lies about why we went to the war. So I've been dealing with this practically. I've been dealing with it now for more than 30 years. And that's why now I have the Whistleblower Newsroom radio show, because I just figured I never wanted to be in front of a camera. I really did not. But I had to. I have to, because, you know, this is our world.
Well, can you tell the listeners about the Whistleblower's Newsroom? When was it started? And how do they access it, subscribe? How do they learn more about what you're bringing to the public?
The Whistleblower Newsroom is a radio show and podcast that was started a couple of years ago. It's a platform for whistleblowers, by whistleblowers, that would be me, and about whistleblowers. And it's for people who are trying to get the truth out and cannot for whatever reason. And certainly this COVID pandemic is it's a very important platform for them. It's on the Progressive Radio Network. It's also on Podbean. You can get it on, it's on various platforms like Podbean. I do have a YouTube channel. I don't even know if anybody can access it right now, but no, I guess you can access it right now. And it's the Whistleblower Newsroom YouTube channel. So, yeah.
Well, I'll let that be the last word, Christina. Thanks for joining me on the McCullough Report.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Is a record player the best way to listen to music? Of course not. So why are you still taking vitamins that haven't been upgraded since the 1930s? Even if your vitamins aren't hard to swallow, it's time to upgrade to Healthy Cells pill-free, patent-pending microgel supplements that work at the cellular level to boost immune health, sleep better, focus deeper, and stay younger longer. They taste great, convenient on the go, and they're more natural too, without chemical binders, fillers, and coatings. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order of any product. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Now, never before in our history have we witnessed the level of hatred that is now being waged against our law enforcement. While anarchist groups create havoc and overwhelm our first responders, these same groups and their corporate supporters are calling for the police forces to be shrunk and defunded. What can you and I do to make a difference? How can we stand up for what is right and to show our support? That's what I'm going to tell you about this incredible new platform. It's called ShopToTheRight.com. And it's a new shopping platform that will help you find businesses that align with your values. They feature products made in America. They support veteran-owned businesses as well as our law enforcement community. This is a time when we need to stick together. We need to shop together and we need to support each other. It's time for you and I to make some noise and stand up to protect our country. And one easy way to do that is to shop and give our money to companies that don't seek to destroy our way of life. So join the fight for liberty. ShopToTheRight.com. Support those American businesses that support law enforcement and veterans.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
It's my great pleasure to invite on this show Dr. Angelina Ferrello. Dr. Ferrello went to undergraduate at Rutgers University and then attended medical school at Ross University and then went on to pediatric residency at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. And she is in private practice as a pediatrician just outside of Houston, between Houston and Galveston. And I've asked her to come on the show, particularly to give the listeners a viewpoint about COVID-19 vaccination and its prospects for use in children. Dr. Ferrello, welcome to the McCullough Report.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
We've heard in the news, we know that the current vaccines are not approved for use in children. But we've heard different viewpoints in the media that we should have a program of vaccination in the children, other viewpoints that we shouldn't. How do you settle out on this since you're seeing the children every day and you're dealing with the parents?
You know, the kids that I'm seeing in my office, honestly, none of them, even if their parents are infected, they have no disease. Some of them have tested completely negative for PCR. Some of them have tested positive for the PCR, but have absolutely no symptoms. Some have very mild symptoms. So, you know, I have yet to see one that is severe, honestly. The ones that tend to have more symptomology tend to be older. We're talking in the late teen group.
So is there any condition where we would vaccinate a child for such a mild condition?
In my view, from what we're seeing statistically, okay, these kiddos are not at risk. As a matter of fact, in some studies, it's showing that they act as a buffer to disease for adults. So when we have the children doing, you know, going to school in masks and things of that nature, I think that's a little bit of overkill because these kids and their immune systems are awesome, especially our younger kiddos, because they still have a thymus. And thymus, of course, is the organ that as they get older goes away. And it also does a great job of producing T cells. And so with all that, there's no need for these children because their risk factors are so low.
So it's not in their best interest. And, you know, as doctors, we have to see patients one by one. The vaccines are emergency use authorized and they're completely voluntary in adults at this point in time. But do you anticipate that they will be expanded for use in children?
I really hope not. I mean, let's look at, you know, I'm looking at some numbers right now. So if you'll indulge me for just a second, you know, even in New York City, where we saw super high rates of COVID illness, COVID hospitalization, COVID mortality. Children were 1.2% to 3% of the total reported hospitalizations, okay? And between 0.1% of all child COVID-19 cases resulted in hospitalization. So this is super low in a very high endemic area. And when you're looking at mortality, and this is reported from 43 states, I'm getting this actually off the American Academy of Pediatrics website. So you can look at this. It's here in print. And it's, you know, children were 0% to 0.19% of all COVID-19 deaths. And 10 states reported zero child deaths. Okay. So when you're looking at this, really, they are at such low risk. You have to weigh the risk benefit. So in the current vaccine milieu that we're dealing with, you know, there's quite a bit of controversy about it because there seems to be some serious side effects in the adults. And is it really worth it to subject our kids who are at such low risk and actually may protect the adults around them to this vaccine? And in my opinion, I'm going to tell you, no, I don't think that's really appropriate.
Well, the CDC and the US FDA can only make it a voluntary offering. It's going to be the doctor with the patient that decides. Let me ask you this. If you had a patient who, let's say, was 16 years old in high school, had a history of asthma, and developed COVID-19 with severe symptoms, is there treatment with today's modern research and what we know?
Oh, absolutely. I've treated actually quite a few kids of that caliber. So, and actually, you know, in my practice, I might be a little unique, but in my practice, I highly recommend vitamin D anyway. I've done that for many, many years, over 10 years, telling all of my asthmatics, it's really important for you to keep your vitamin D levels high because we know from research that the higher their vitamin D levels, the lower their reaction rate to their asthma. So it actually helps keep them from picking up all kinds of lovely things that will trigger their asthma symptoms. So in my practice, you know, that is kind of a mainstay and has been a mainstay for a long time. We do use vitamin D in acute respiratory disease. I tell that to people for years. That has not been something new for me. We've also been using lots of, I'm a very aggressive person when it comes to treating asthmatics and making sure that they are on their preventative medications, such as budesonide. You know, budesonide for me is a mainstay. I use that all the time. That is not a new medication. We've been using that for many, many years. As a matter of fact, it came out, I believe it was my second year of residency, way back in the day. And so we used it extensively then to prevent asthma attacks. You can use that acutely as well. And we're seeing great effects with that. We use, you know, your other respiratory medications such as azithromycin works wonderfully because it has a minor bronchodilator effect. And so in those kiddos that, especially in the 16-year-old age group, there tends to be a higher incidence of thing of atypical pneumonias like your mycoplasma, things of that nature. So I routinely will use azithromycin. I will use rarely, I will use oral prednisone or prednisolone. It's not typical. I personally in kiddos like to use the inhaled steroids because I feel it works better than just overall oral prednisone. So when I have them on that, I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, there is great safety data when it comes to hydroxychloroquine. And in our area, believe it or not, we have a lot of missionary families. And so for years, I was prescribing that when they left the continent of the United States going to high endemic areas. And so HCQ, when it came on, I was doing my research back in March of 2020. And it came up and it was like, oh, I've prescribed this before. And, you know, so that was something that I did keep in my back pocket. And with talking with other physicians who are treating, actively treating early outpatient, and when the AAPS and your paper came out, I was just elated that that is one of our choices. And yes, I use it. I do prescribe it for outpatient treatment and it works really well in these kids.
Well, I think the main point for the parents are that the vaccination, it appears as if the risks would outweigh the benefits, that it's not in their best interest to be mass vaccinated. And if they develop COVID-19 with severe symptoms, doctors like Dr. Farrell and other skilled pediatricians can clearly treat the illness. Dr. Farrell, do you have any final words for our audience?
I just think, you know, we have to really understand the whole gambit of COVID-19 and children. You know, I think we have a fear of, we want to protect our kids. I totally understand that. I do understand, I use vaccine all the time in my practice. That is, you know, a mainstay of my practice in pediatrics. There's a underlying or undercurrent feeling that these kids could potentially infect the adults, which we are seeing time after time and study after study, that is not the case. And I think these poor kids are really bearing a cross that it's not there to bear. And I think if we all just kind of think about the current treatments available, this is definitely beatable in a kiddo. Absolutely. Vaccinating kids that are at such low risk with the potentiation of a high risk adverse event happening, I'm going to say, you know, in my opinion, and I've been in pediatrics for 25 years now, that this is not a good idea. I would not recommend that to my patient population at all. As a matter of fact, I have told some of my older teenagers that are college age students not to participate in the vaccination until more studies come out about safety and efficacy. Right now, in its emergency use, that is not something that I would recommend to my patient population at all or my families.
Well, I'll let that be the last word. Keep in mind regarding vaccination, you know, as doctors, we see patients one by one, and the vaccines are always to protect the patient. So for instance, all the standard mumps, measles, rubella, tetanus shots, when we get to the point they go to college, they get meningococcal vaccine, for instance. It's always to protect the child. There's never a circumstance where we would vaccinate the child at the child's expense and risk to protect others. You're listening to the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Well, it's been a busy week in the medical media, and I wanted to report back to you on a few media spots that I've had during the week as a leader in the COVID-19 pandemic response. On April 5th, I had a spot on Laura Ingraham, the Ingraham Angle, on Fox National Television. Let's listen.
Joining me now is Dr. Peter McCullough, internist and cardiologist. Doctor, another benefit to keeping this crisis going, the hundreds of billions of dollars set to be made on the continued production of these vaccines and then booster vaccine shots to follow. Now, you actually think the whole response has been too narrowly focused on the vaccines. Explain.
Well, what's really changed the calculus in the whole pandemic is early treatment for COVID-19. There's now 10 national telemedicine services, 15 regional services, 250 treating doctors across the United States. The Association of American Physicians and Surgeons has a home treatment guide. We're using multiple drugs in combination to reduce the spread of illness and reduce hospitalizations and deaths. So that's changed everything. As you implied, Texas has been an early treatment state all the way through. We never closed down. We're in the middle of the pack in terms of cases and mortality, and we've moved on. Now, the overall approach to the pandemic, I think, has been way too much focused on masks and vaccines. Neither one of those helped sick patients with COVID-19. That's playing defense. And in my view, the big change was when we had the Senate hearings in November, we started playing offense.
Well, doctor, that also brings up this issue of vaccine mandates or passports or certificates. And the issue of T-cell immunity, which doesn't get enough attention, but that is basically the natural immunity people get if they're exposed to the virus. And a lot of people don't have any symptoms whatsoever, but they're T-cell positive. How important is that factor to measuring the severity of any ongoing crisis?
Well, the T-cell technologies have dramatically improved. There's an FDA-cleared test now that one can actually have the DNA from their T-cells extracted and tested to see if, in fact, there has been prior exposure to COVID-19 and inferred immunity. But keep in mind, it's T-cell, it's a natural killer cell, and innate immunity that gives that full library of defense mechanisms in addition to antibodies. So the natural immunity is far more broad, durable, and complete than the vaccine immunity. We recommend vaccines, and I'm very pro-vaccine, and have taken all the vaccines that are safe and effective myself, and my patients and my family members have taken the COVID-19 vaccine where appropriate, but it provides a narrow base of immunity that protects those most vulnerable. In my view, it should not be widely applied to individuals who have a very low risk for COVID-19 and a near zero risk for hospitalization and death.
And if so, if you are T-cell positive already in this new T-cell direct test you can get, why would you get the vaccine?
The vaccine wouldn't be supportable in that person. That person can go about their life with great confidence that they're at negligible risk for reinfection.
All right, doctor, another worrying example of this forever pandemic mindset we talked about on The Angle is the CDC, they are not backing down on these insane guidelines for masking of children. Here's the director of the CDC today.
If people are playing tennis and they're far away, we can say that their masks can come off. But if they're crowded on a soccer field, they're on top of each other, they're heavily breathing, we don't really think that's a good idea right now. These are kids who likely will not be vaccinated. We've seen a lot of outbreaks associated with youth sports.
Now, there was actually a study done on that in September. Out of 282 positive cases reported among players, only one was attributed to transmission while playing soccer. Doctor, masks on athletes, so someone who was an athlete in high school, that's just insane.
It is insane, and I can tell you there's no scientific support for masking athletes. It's going to do more harm than good. And our kids can go out and play freely. Communicability is so sufficiently low. And keep in mind, kids get through this illness with really no problems, and severe cases are easily treatable. Pediatricians treat this with some mild inhalers and oral drugs. We always get the kids through the infection. So I say, leave the masks off the kids, leave them out of the vaccination discussion, and let's go on with life.
Dr. McCullough, great to see you tonight. Thanks so much.
Now, I wanted to fill in that and prepare you that I will have a full hour on Tucker Carlson, Fox Nation Today, and that'll appear on May 7th, 2021 at 4 p.m. Eastern. And you can go back in the Fox News Channel files and find that clip. And we do thoroughly explore the issue about early treatment of COVID-19, where we are in the pandemic response. And I think the paradigm that I want you to think about is a football game, that wearing masks, isolation, lockdown, hand sanitizers, and then waiting for a vaccine, all of those things apply to a well person who's trying to not get the virus. In a sense, they're fear-based measures, and it's clearly defensive. They are defensive measures. We never win a war just by playing defense. COVID-19 pandemic is a war. It's a worldwide war, and we have to go on offense. And the way we go on offense is we treat patients early for the illness. And as we do, we avoid hospitalization and death in high-risk individuals. We have an 85% efficacy rate in reducing hospitalizations and deaths. And then patients become naturally immune. The natural immunity is robust, complete, and durable. And the published studies suggest that the antibodies against the spike protein, the nucleocapsid, the other components of the virus, the cellular response, which is the T helper cells, the T natural killer cells, as well as the innate immunity on the cell surface of T cells, is dramatically robust. In fact, the T cell immunity to the natural infection is probably a hundredfold that of what the vaccine immunity can do. The vaccine, however, creates higher levels of a narrow library of antibodies directed against the original Wuhan virus spike protein. Now, unfortunately, that strain of the virus is long gone. We have 14 new strains in the United States. None of them are the original Wuhan wild-type virus, but we're hoping that the vaccine, in fact, can create a high enough antibody titer that it could fend off these other mutant strains. And the data do suggest, in fact, that's the case. I don't want anyone to be worried that if they've had the vaccine, that it's going to be useless against the variants. We know the vaccine in general against the original Wuhan wild-type virus was partially effective. And partially effective in many ways is better than no efficacy. I've worked very carefully with Dr. Andy Bostrom, who you've heard on the program. And Andy has done a terrific job in analyzing the data. And we have come up with the conclusion that the risks-benefit relationship for the vaccine starts to tip in favor of getting vaccinated age over 50, with high contact jobs, such as a nursing home worker or a dentist, a barber, someone who's having a lot of patient exposure, someone in a dialysis unit or in a chemotherapy infusion center, those individuals age over 50, that the benefits outweigh the risks. Everyone else, it really doesn't apply. In fact, the risks of the vaccine outweigh the benefits. Natural immunity superior to vaccine-induced immunity, and be better off having the infection, managing through it and developing natural immunity. That's really the way to go on offense and beat COVID-19. So as I leave you today, I want you to think about the following, that you're faced with a whole series of decisions now. Things are starting to crunch down in terms of travel, employment, social interactions in church. And so much has been focused on the partially effective and really highly unsafe COVID-19 vaccine with respect to deaths and hospitalizations. And it can only be characterized as that. You'll see that this week on Tucker Carlson, on his monologue, he has a full 45 minutes on vaccine safety and really exposes the numbers. And many of us now are pushing the US FDA, the NIH, the CDC, the vaccine manufacturers, White House Task Force, those are all the vaccine stakeholders. We're pushing them hard to have an independent, unbiased data safety monitoring board review the data and come up with recommendations so we can make the vaccine program more safe. The rate of vaccination has dramatically slowed in the United States. Almost everybody knows someone who's been injured or has died in association with the COVID-19 vaccine. Those are solemn words, but I'll let them be the last words for this issue of the McCullough Report. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.